Chapter 2. The Way Station. 1. A nursery rhyme had been playing itself through his mind all day, the maddening kind of thing that will not let go, that mockingly ignores all commands of the conscious mind to cease and desist. The rhyme was, "The rain in Spain falls on the plain. There is joy and also pain, but the rain in Spain falls on the plain. Time's a sheet, life's a stain. All the things we know will change, and all those things remain the same. But be ye mad or only sane, the rain in Spain falls on the plain. We walk in love, but fly in chains, and the plains in Spain fall in the rain." He didn't know what a plain was in the context of the rhyme's last couplet, but knew why the rhyme had occurred to him in the first place. There had been the recurring dream of his room in the castle, and of his mother, who had sung it to him as he lay solemnly in a tiny bed by the window of many colors. She did not sing it at bedtimes, because all small boys born to the high speech must face the dark alone. But she sang to him at nap-times, and he could remember the heavy gray rain-light that shivered into rainbows on the counterpane. He could feel the coolness of the room and the heavy warmth of blankets, love for his mother and her red lips, the haunting melody of the little nonsense lyric, and her voice. Now it came back maddeningly, like a dog chasing its own tail in his mind as he walked. All his water was gone, and he knew he was very likely a dead man. He had never expected it to come to this, and he was sorry. Since noon he had been watching his feet rather than the way ahead. Out here, even the devil grass had grown stunted and yellow. The hard pan had disintegrated in places to mere rubble. The mountains were not noticeably clear, although 16 days had passed since he had left the hut of the last homesteader, a loony, sane young man on the edge of the desert. He had had a bird, the gunslinger remembered, but he couldn't remember the bird's name. He watched his feet move up and down like the heddles of a loom, listened to the nonsense rhyme sing itself into a pitiful garble in his mind, and wondered when he would fall down for the first time. He didn't want to fall. Even though there was no one to see him, it was a matter of pride. A gunslinger knows pride, that invisible bone that keeps the neck stiff. What hadn't come to him from his father had been kicked into him by Court, a boy's gentleman if there ever was one. Court, yeah, with his red bulb of a nose and his scarred face. He stopped and looked up suddenly. It made his head buzz, and for a moment his whole body seemed to float. The mountains dreamed against the far horizon, but there was something else up ahead, something much closer, perhaps only 5 miles away. He squinted at it, but his eyes were sandblasted and going glare blind. He shook his head and began to walk again. The rhyme circled and buzzed. About an hour later he fell down and skinned his hands. He looked at the tiny beads of blood on his flaked skin with disbelief. The blood looked no thinner. It looked like any blood, now dying in the air. It seemed almost as smug as the desert. He dashed the drops away, hating them blindly. Smug? Why not? The blood was not thirsty. The blood was being served. The blood was being made sacrifice unto. Blood sacrifice. All the blood needed to do was run, and run, and run. He looked at the splotches that had landed on the hard pan and watched as they were sucked up with uncanny suddenness. How do you like that, blood? How does that suit you? Oh, Jesus, I'm far gone. He got up, holding his hands to his chest, and the thing he'd seen earlier was almost in front of him, so close it made him cry out, a dust-choked crow-croak. It was a building, no, two buildings, surrounded by a fallen rail fence. The wood seemed old, fragile to the point of elvishness. It was wood being transmogrified into sand. One of the buildings had been a stable. The shape was clear and unmistakable. The other was a house, or an inn, a way station for the coach line. The tottering sand house, the wind had crusted the wood with grit until it looked like a sand castle that the sun had beat upon at low tide and hardened to a temporary abode, cast a thin line of shadow, and someone sat in the shadow, leaning against the building, and the building seemed to lean with the burden of his weight. Him, then. At last. The man in black. The gunslinger stood with his hands to his chest, unaware of his declamatory posture, and gawped. But instead of the tremendous winging excitement he had expected, or perhaps fear or awe, there was nothing but the dim atavistic guilt for the sudden raging hate of his own blood moments earlier, and the endless ring arosy of the childhood song, The Rain in Spain. He moved forward, drawing one gun. Falls on the plain. He came the last quarter mile at a jolting, flat-footed run, not trying to hide himself. There was nothing to hide behind. His short shadow raced him. He was not aware that his face had become a gray and dusty death mask of exhaustion. He was aware of nothing but the figure in the shadow. It did not occur to him until later that the figure might even have been dead. He kicked through one of the leaning fence rails, it broke in two without a sound, almost apologetically, and lunged across the dazzled and silent stable yard, bringing the gun up. "You're covered! You're covered! Hands up, you whoreson! You're—" The figure moved restlessly and stood up. The gunslinger thought, "My God, he is worn away to nothing. What's happened to him?" Because the man in black had shrunk 2 full feet, and his hair had gone white. He paused, struck dumb, his head buzzing tunelessly. His heart was racing at a lunatic rate, and he thought, "I'm dying right here." He sucked the white-hot air into his lungs and hung his head for a moment. When he raised it again, he saw it wasn't the man in black, but a boy with sun-bleached hair, regarding him with eyes that did not even seem interested. The gunslinger stared at him blankly and then shook his head in negation. But the boy survived his refusal to believe. He was a strong delusion, one wearing blue jeans with a patch on one knee and a plain brown shirt of rough weave. The gunslinger shook his head again and started for the stable with his head lowered, gun still in hand. He couldn't think yet. His head was filled with motes, and there was a huge, thrumming ache building in it. The inside of the stable was silent and dark and exploding with heat. The gunslinger stared around himself with huge, floating wall eyes. He made a drunken about-face and saw the boy standing in the ruined doorway, staring at him. A blade of pain slipped smoothly into his head, cutting from temple to temple, dividing his brain like an orange. He reholstered his gun, swayed, put out his hands as if to ward off phantoms, and fell over on his face. Two. When he woke up, he was on his back, and there was a pile of light, odorless hay beneath his head. The boy had not been able to move him, but he had made him reasonably comfortable, and he was cool. He looked down at himself and saw that his shirt was dark and wet. He looked at his face and tasted water. He blinked at it. His tongue seemed to swell in his mouth. The boy was hunkered down beside him. When he saw the gunslinger's eyes were open, he reached behind him and gave the gunslinger a dented tin can filled with water. He grasped it with trembling hands and allowed himself to drink a little, just a little. When that was down and sitting in his belly, he drank a little more. Then he spilled the rest over his face and made shocked, blowing noises. The boy's pretty lips curved in a solemn little smile. "Would you want something to eat, sir?" "Not yet," the gunslinger said. There was still a sick ache in his head from the sunstroke, and the water sat uneasily in his stomach as if it did not know where to go. "Who are you?"
"My name is John Chambers. You can call me Jake. I have a friend, well, sort of a friend, she works for us, who calls me Bama sometimes, but you can call me Jake."
The gunslinger sat up, and the sick ache became hard and immediate. He leaned forward and lost a brief struggle with his stomach.
"There's more," Jake said.
He took the can and walked toward the rear of the stable. He paused and smiled back at the gunslinger uncertainly. The gunslinger nodded at him and then put his head down and propped it with his hands. The boy was well made, handsome, perhaps 10 or 11. There had been a shadow of fear on his face, but that was all right. The gunslinger would have trusted him far less if the boy hadn't shown fear. A strange thumping hum began at the rear of the stable. The gunslinger raised his head alertly, hands going to the butts of his guns. The sound lasted for perhaps 15 seconds and then quit. The boy came back with the can, filled now. The gunslinger drank sparingly again, and this time it was a little better. The ache in his head was fading.
"I didn't know what to do with you when you fell down," Jake said. "For a couple of seconds there, I thought you were going to shoot me."
"Maybe I was. I thought you were somebody else."
"The priest?"
The gunslinger looked up sharply. The boy studied him, frowning.
"He camped in the yard. I was in the house over there. Or maybe it was a depot. I didn't like him, so I didn't come out. He came in the night and went on the next day. I would have hidden from you, but I was sleeping when you came."
He looked darkly over the gunslinger's head.
"I don't like people. They fuck me up."
"What did he look like?" The boy shrugged.
"Like a priest. He was wearing black things."
"A hood and a cassock?"
"What's a cassock?"
"A robe, like a dress." The boy nodded.
"That's about right."
The gunslinger leaned forward, and something in his face made the boy recoil a little. "How long ago? Tell me, for your father's sake."
I...
Patiently, the gunslinger said, "I'm not going to hurt you."
"I don't know. I can't remember time. Every day is the same."
For the first time, the gunslinger wondered consciously how the boy had come to this place with dry and man-killing leagues of desert all around it. But he would not make it his concern, not yet, at least. "Make your best guess. Long ago?"
"No, not long. I haven't been here long."
The fire lit in him again. He snatched up the can and drank from it with hands that trembled the smallest bit. A fragment of the cradle song recurred, but this time, instead of his mother's face, he saw the scarred face of Alice, who had been his Jilly in the now-defunct town of Tull. "A week? 2? 3? The boy looked at him distractedly.
"Yes."
"Which?"
"A week? Or 2?
He looked aside, blushing a little.
3 poops ago, that's the only way I can measure things now." "He didn't even drink. I thought he might be the ghost of a priest, like in this movie I saw once, only Zorro figured out he wasn't a priest at all, or a ghost either. He was just a banker who wanted some land because there was gold on it. Mrs. Shaw took me to see that movie. It was in Times Square."
None of this made any sense to the gunslinger, so he did not comment on it.
"I was scared," the boy said. "I've been scared almost all the time."
His face quivered like crystal on the edge of the ultimate destructive high note.
"He didn't even build a fire. He just sat there. I don't even know if he went to sleep."
Close. Closer than he had ever been, by the gods. In spite of his extreme dehydration, his hands felt faintly moist, greasy.
"There's some dried meat," the boy said.
"All right." The gunslinger nodded. "Good." The boy got up to fetch it, his knees popping slightly. He made a fine, straight figure. The desert had not yet sapped him. His arms were thin, but the skin, although tanned, had not dried and cracked. "He's got juice," the gunslinger thought. "Mayhap some sand in his craw as well, or he would have taken one of my guns and shot me right where I lay." Or perhaps the boy simply hadn't thought of it. The gunslinger drank from the can again. "Sand in his craw or not, he didn't come from this place." Jake came back with a pile of dried jerky on what looked like a sun-scoured breadboard. The meat was tough stringy and salty enough to make the cankered lining of the gunslinger's mouth sing. He ate and drank until he felt logy, and then settled back. The boy ate only a little, picking at the dark strands with an odd delicacy. The gunslinger regarded him, and the boy looked back at him candidly enough. "Where did you come from, Jake?" he asked finally.
"I don't know." The boy frowned. "I did know. I knew when I came here, but it's all fuzzy now, like a bad dream when you wake up. I have lots of bad dreams. Mrs. Shaw used to say it was because I watched too many horror movies on Channel 11.
"What's a channel?" A wild idea occurred to him. "Is it like a beam?"
"No. It's TV."
"What's TV?" The boy touched his forehead.
"Pictures."
"Did somebody tote you here, this Mrs. Shaw?"
"No," the boy said. "I just was here."
"Who is Mrs. Shaw?"
"I don't know."
"Why did she call you Bama?"
"I don't remember."
"You're not making any sense," the gunslinger said flatly. Quite suddenly, the boy was on the verge of tears.
"I can't help it. I was just here. If you asked me about TV and channels yesterday, I bet I still could have remembered. Tomorrow, I probably won't even remember I'm Jake. Not unless you tell me, and you won't be here, will you? You're going to go away and I'll starve because you ate up almost all my food. I didn't ask to be here. I don't like it. It's spooky."
"Don't feel so sorry for yourself. Make do."
"I didn't ask to be here,"
the boy repeated with bewildered defiance. The gunslinger ate another piece of the meat. Chewing the salt out of it before swallowing, the boy had become part of it, and the gunslinger was convinced he told the truth. He had not asked for it. It was too bad. He had asked for it. But he had not asked for the game to become this dirty. He had not asked to turn his guns on the townsfolk of Tull. Had not asked to shoot Allie, with her sadly pretty face at the end, marked by the secret she had finally asked to be let in on, using that word, that 19, like a key in a lock. Had not asked to be faced with a choice between duty and flat-out murder. It was not fair to ring in innocent bystanders and make them speak lines they didn't understand on a strange stage. Allie, he thought, Allie was at least part of this world in her own self-illusory way. But this boy, this goddamned boy. "Tell me what you can remember," he told Jake.
"It's only a little. It doesn't seem to make any sense anymore."
"Tell me. Maybe I can pick up the sense." The boy thought about how to begin. He thought about it very hard.
"There was a place. The one before this one? A high place with lots of rooms and a patio where you could look at tall buildings and water. There was a statue that stood in the water."
"A statue in the water?"
"Yes. A lady with a crown and a torch and, I think, a book."
"Are you making this up?"
"I guess I must be," the boy said hopelessly. "There were things to ride in on the streets, big ones and little ones. The big ones were blue and white. The little ones were yellow. A lot of yellow ones. I walked to school. There were cement paths beside the streets. Windows to look in and more statues wearing clothes. The statues sold the clothes. I know it sounds crazy, but the statues sold the clothes."
The gunslinger shook his head and looked for a lie on the boy's face. He saw none.
"I walked to school," the boy repeated doggedly. "And I had a..."
His eyes tilted, closed, and his lips moved gropingly.
"A brown book bag. I carried a lunch, and I wore..."
The groping again, agonized groping.
"A tie."
"A cravat?"
"I don't know."
The boy's fingers made a slow, unconscious, clinching motion at his throat, one the gunslinger associated with hanging.
"I don't know. It's just all gone."
And he looked away. "May I put you to sleep?" the gunslinger asked.
"I'm not sleepy."
"I can make you sleepy. And I can make you remember." Doubtfully, Jake asked,
"How could you do that?"
with this." The gunslinger removed one of the shells from his gun belt and twirled it in his fingers. The movement was dexterous, as flowing as oil. The shell cartwheeled effortlessly from thumb and index to index and second to second and ring to ring and pinky. It popped out of sight and reappeared, seemed to float briefly, then reversed. The shell walked across the gunslinger's fingers. The fingers themselves marched as his feet had marched on his last miles to this place. The boy watched, his initial doubt first replaced with plain delight, then by raptness, then by dawning blankness, as he opened. His eyes slipped shut. The shell danced back and forth. Jake's eyes opened again, caught the steady, limpid movement between the gunslinger's fingers a little while longer, and then they closed once more. The gunslinger continued the howken, but Jake's eyes did not open again. The boy breathed with slow and steady calmness. Did this have to be part of it? Yes, it did. There was a certain cold beauty to it, like the lacy frettings that fringe hard blue ice packs. He once more seemed to hear his mother singing, not the nonsense about the rain in Spain this time, but sweeter nonsense coming from a great distance as he rocked on the rim of sleep. "Baby Bunting, baby dear, baby, bring your basket here." Not for the first time the gunslinger tasted the smooth, loaden taste of soul sickness. The shell in his fingers, manipulated with such unknown grace, was suddenly horrific, the spoor of a monster. He dropped it into his palm, made a fist, and squeezed it with painful force. Had it exploded, in that moment he would have rejoiced at the destruction of his talented hand, for its only true talent was murder. There had always been murder in the world, but telling himself so was no comfort. There was murder, there was rape. There were unspeakable practices, and all of them were for the good, the bloody good, the bloody myth, for the Grail, for the Tower. Ah, the Tower stood somewhere in the middle of things, so they did say, rearing its black-gray bulk to the sky, and in his desert-scoured ears the gunslinger heard the faint, sweet sound of his mother's voice. "Chuzzit, chizzit, chazzit, bring enough to fill your basket." He brushed the song and the sweetness of the song aside. "Where are you?" he asked. 3. Jake Chambers, sometimes Bama, is going downstairs with his book bag. There is earth science, there is geography, there is a notepad, a pencil, a lunch his mother's cook, Mrs. Greta Shaw, has made for him in the chrome and formica kitchen, where a fan whirs eternally, sucking up alien odors. In his lunch sack he has a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, a bologna lettuce and onion sandwich, and 4 Oreo cookies. His parents do not hate him, but they do seem to have overlooked him. They have abdicated and left him to Mrs. Greta Shaw, to nannies, to a tutor in the summer, and the Piper School, which is private and nice, and most of all white, the rest of the time. None of these people have ever pretended to be more than what they are, professional people, the best in their fields. None have folded him to a particularly warm bosom, as usually happens in the historical romance novels his mother reads, and which Jake has dipped into, looking for the hot parts. Hysterical novels, his father sometimes calls them, and sometimes bodice rippers. "You should talk," his mother says, with infinite scorn, from behind some closed door where Jake listens. His father works for the Network, and Jake could pick him out of a lineup of skinny men with crew cuts. Probably. Jake does not know that he hates all the professional people, but Mrs. Shaw. People have always bewildered him. His mother, who is scrawny in a sexy way, often goes to bed with sick friends. His father sometimes talks about people at the Network who are doing too much Coca-Cola. This statement is always accompanied by a humorless grin and a quick little sniff of the thumbnail. Now, he's on the street. Jake Chambers is on the street. He has hit the bricks. He is clean and well-mannered, comely, sensitive. He bowls once a week at Midtown Lanes. He has no friends, only acquaintances. He has never bothered to think about this, but it hurts him. He does not know or understand that a long association with professional people has caused him to take on many of their traits. Mrs. Greta Shaw, better than the rest of them, but gosh, is that ever a consolation prize, makes very professional sandwiches. She quarters them and cuts off the bread crusts so that when he eats in the gym period four, he looks like he ought to be at a cocktail party with a drink in his other hand instead of a sports novel or a Clay Blaisdell Western from the school library. His father makes a great deal of money because he is a master of the kill, that is, placing a stronger show on his network against a weaker show on a rival network. His father smokes four packs of cigarettes a day. His father does not cough, but he has a hard grin, and he's not averse to the occasional shot of the old Coca-Cola. Down the street. His mother leaves cab fare, but he walks every day it doesn't rain, swinging his book bag and sometimes his bowling bag, although mostly he leaves it in his locker, a small boy who looks very American with his blonde hair and blue eyes. Girls have already begun to notice him, with their mother's approval, and he does not shy away with skittish little boy arrogance. He talks to them with unknowing professionalism and puzzles them away. He likes geography and bowling in the afternoon. His father owns stock in a company that makes automatic pin-setting machinery, but Midtown Lanes does not use his father's brand. He does not think he has thought about this, but he has. Walking down the street, he passes Bloomie's, where the models stand dressed in fur coats, in six-button Edwardian suits, some in nothing at all, some are bare-naked. These models, these mannequins, are perfectly professional, and he hates all professionalism. He is too young to have learned to hate himself yet, but that seed is already there. Given time, it will grow and bear bitter fruit. He comes to the corner and stands with his book bag at his side. Traffic roars by, grunting blue and white buses, yellow taxis, Volkswagens, a large truck. He is just a boy, but not average. And he sees the man who kills him out of the corner of his eye. It is the man in black. And he doesn't see the face, only the swirling robe, the outstretched hands, and the hard, professional grin. He falls into the street with his arms outstretched, not letting go of the book bag which contains Mrs. Greta Shaw's extremely professional lunch. There is a brief glance through a polarized windshield at the horrified face of a businessman wearing a dark blue hat, in the band of which is a small, jaunty feather. Somewhere, a radio is blasting rock and roll. An old woman on the far curb screams. She is wearing a black hat with a net. Nothing jaunty about that black net. It is like a mourner's veil. Jake feels nothing but surprise, and his usual sense of headlong bewilderment. Is this how it ends? Before he's bowled better than 270? He lands hard in the street, and looks at an asphalt-sealed crack some 2 inches from his eyes. The book bag is jolted from his hand. He is wondering if he has skinned his knees when the car belonging to the businessman wearing the blue hat with the jaunty feather passes over him. It is a big blue 1976 Cadillac with white-wall Firestone tires. The car is almost exactly the same color as the businessman's hat. It breaks Jake's back, mushes his guts to gravy, and sends blood from his mouth in a high-pressure jet. He turns his head and sees the Cadillac's flaming taillights and smoke spurting from beneath its locked rear wheels. The car has also run over his book bag and left a wide black tread on it. He turns his head the other way and sees a large gray Ford screaming to a stop inches from his body. A black fellow who has been selling pretzels and sodas from a pushcart is coming toward him on the run. Blood runs from Jake's nose, ears, eyes, rectum. His genitals have been squashed. He wonders irritably how badly he has skinned his knees. He wonders if he'll be late for school. Now the driver of the Cadillac is running toward him, babbling. Somewhere a terrible, calm voice, the voice of doom, says, "I am a priest. Let me through. An act of contrition." He sees the black robe and knows sudden horror. It is him, the man in black. Jake turns his face away with the last of his strength. Somewhere a radio is playing a song by the rock group Kiss. He sees his own hand trailing on the pavement, small, white, shapely. He has never bitten his nails. Looking at his hand, Jake dies. 4. The gunslinger hunkered in frowning thought. He was tired and his body ached, and the thoughts came with aggravating slowness. Across from him, the amazing boy slept with his hands folded in his lap, still breathing calmly. He had told his tale without much emotion, although his voice had trembled near the end when he had come to the part about the priest and the act of contrition. He had not, of course, told the gunslinger about his family and his own sense of bewildered dichotomy, but that had seeped through anyway, enough for the gunslinger to make out its shape. The fact that there had never been such a city as the boy described, unless it was the mythic city of Lud, was not the most upsetting part of the story, but it was disturbing. It was all disturbing. The gunslinger was afraid of the implications. "Jake?"
"Uh-huh."
"Do you want to remember this when you wake up, or forget it?"
"Forget it," the boy said promptly. "When the blood came out of my mouth, I could taste my own shit."
"All right. You're going to sleep, understand? Real sleep now. Go ahead and lie over, if it do please you." Jake laid over, looking small and peaceful and harmless. The gunslinger did not believe he was harmless. There was a deadly feeling about him, the stink of yet another trap. He didn't like the feeling, but he liked the boy. He liked him a great deal. "Jake?"
"Shh. I'm sleeping. I want to sleep."
"Yes, and when you wake up, you won't remember any of this."
"Okay. Good."
The gunslinger watched him for a brief time, thinking of his own boyhood, which usually seemed to have happened to another person, to a person who had leaped through some fabulous lens of time to become someone else, but which now seemed poignantly close. It was very hot in the stable of the way station, and he carefully drank some more water. He got up and walked to the back of the building, pausing to look into one of the horse stalls. There was a small pile of white hay in the corner, and a neatly folded blanket, but there was no smell of horse. There was no smell of anything in the stable. The sun had bled away every smell and left nothing. The air was perfectly neutral. At the back of the stable was a small, dark room with a stainless steel machine in the center. It was untouched by rust or rot. It looked like a butter churn. At the left, a chrome pipe jutted from it, terminating over a drain in the floor. The gunslinger had seen pumps like it in other dry places, but never one so big. He could not contemplate how deep they— some long gone, they must have drilled before they struck water, secret and forever black under the desert. Why hadn't they removed the pump when the way station had been abandoned? Demons, perhaps. He shuddered abruptly, an abrupt twisting of his back. Heat flesh poked out on his skin, then receded. He went to the control switch and pushed the on button. The machine began to hum. After perhaps half a minute, a stream of cool, clear water belched from the pipe and went down the drain to be recirculated. Perhaps 3 gallons flowed out of the pipe before the pump shut itself down with a final click. It was a thing as alien to this place and time as true love, and yet as concrete as a judgment, a silent reminder of the time when the world had not yet moved on. It probably ran on an atomic slug, as there was no electricity within 1,000 miles of here, and even dry batteries would have lost their charge long ago. It had been made by a company called North Central Positronics. The gunslinger didn't like it. He went back and sat down beside the boy, who had put one hand under his cheek. Nice-looking boy. The gunslinger drank some more water and crossed his legs, so he was sitting Indian fashion. The boy, like the squatter on the edge of the desert who kept the bird, Zoltan, the gunslinger remembered abruptly, the bird's name was Zoltan, had lost his sense of time. But the fact that the man in black was closer seemed beyond doubt. Not for the first time, the gunslinger wondered if the man in black was letting him catch up for some reason of his own. Perhaps the gunslinger was playing into his hands. He tried to imagine what the confrontation might be like, and could not. He was very hot, but no longer felt sick. The nursery rhyme occurred to him again, but this time, instead of his mother, he thought of Cort. Cort, an ageless engine of a man, his face stitched with the scars of bricks and bullets and blunt instruments, the scars of war and instruction in the arts of war. He wondered if Cort had ever had a love to match those monumental scars. He doubted it. He thought of Susan, and his mother, and of Martin, that incomplete enchanter. The gunslinger was not a man to dwell on the past, only a shadowy conception of the future and of his own emotional makeup saved him from being a man without imagination, a dangerous dullard. His present run of thought, therefore, rather amazed him. Each name called up others. Cuthbert. Alan. The old man Jonas with his quavery voice. And again, Susan, the lovely girl at the window. Such thoughts always came back to Susan and the great rolling plain known as the Drop, and fishermen casting their nets in the bays on the edge of the clean sea. The piano player in Tull, also dead, all dead in Tull, and by his hand, had known those places, although he and the gunslinger had only spoken of them that once. Sheb had been fond of the old songs, had once played them in a saloon called The Traveler's Rest, and the gunslinger hummed one tunelessly under his breath. Love, oh, careless love. See what careless love has done. The gunslinger laughed, bemused. I am the last of that green and warm-hued world. And for all his nostalgia, he felt no self-pity. The world had moved on mercilessly. But his legs were still strong, and the man in black was closer. The gunslinger nodded out. Five. When he awoke, it was almost dark and the boy was gone. The gunslinger got up, hearing his joints pop, and went to the stable door. There was a small flame dancing in darkness on the porch of the inn. He walked toward it, his shadow long and black and trailing in the reddish ochre light of sunset. Jake was sitting by a kerosene lamp. "The oil was in a drum," he said, "but I was scared to burn it in the house, everything's so dry." "You did just right." The gunslinger sat down, seeing but not thinking about the dust of years that puffed up around his rump. He thought it something of a wonder that the porch didn't simply collapse beneath their combined weight. The flame from the lamp shadowed the boy's face with delicate tones. The gunslinger produced his poke and rolled a cigarette. "We have to palaver," he said. Jake nodded, smiling a little at the word. I guess you know I'm on the prod for that man you saw.
Are you going to kill him?
I don't know. I have to make him tell me something. I may have to make him take me someplace.
Where?
To find a tower, the gunslinger said.
He held his cigarette over the chimney of the lamp and drew on it. The smoke drifted away on the rising night breeze. Jake watched it. His face showed neither fear nor curiosity, certainly not enthusiasm.
So I'm going on tomorrow, the gunslinger said. You'll have to come with me. How much of that meat is left?
Only a little.
Corn?
A little more.
The gunslinger nodded. Is there a cellar?
Yes.
Jake looked at him. The pupils of his eyes had grown to a huge, fragile size.
You pull up on a ring in the floor, but I didn't go down. I was afraid the ladder would break and I wouldn't be able to get up again. And it smells bad. It's the only thing around here that smells at all.
We'll get up early and see if there's anything down there worth taking. Then we'll go.
All right.
The boy paused and then said,
I'm glad I didn't kill you when you were sleeping. I had a pitchfork and I thought about doing it, but I didn't, and now I won't have to be afraid to go to sleep.
What would you be afraid of?
The boy looked at him ominously.
Spooks. Of him coming back.
The man in black,
the gunslinger said. Not a question.
Yes. Is he a bad man?
I guess that depends on where you're standing, the gunslinger said absently.
He got up and pitched his cigarette out onto the hardpan.
I'm going to sleep.
The boy looked at him timidly.
Can I sleep in the stable with you?
Of course.
The gunslinger stood on the steps, looking up, and the boy joined him. Old Star was up there, and Old Mother. It seemed to the gunslinger that if he closed his eyes, he would be able to hear the croaking of the first spring peepers, smell the green, almost summer smell of the court lawns after their first cutting, and hear, perhaps, the indolent click of wooden balls as the ladies of the East Wing, attired only in their shifts as dusk glimmered toward dark, played at points. Could almost see Cuthbert and Jamie as they came through the break in the hedges, calling for him to ride out with them. It was not like him to think so much of the past. He turned back and picked up the lamp.
Let's go to sleep, he said.
They crossed to the stable together.